From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The streets seem to be on fire across Latin America. Protesters in Chile, Brazil, Haiti, Colombia, and elsewhere, drawing a variety of responses from the U.S.-backed Organization of American States to help understand what's going on in the region. We spoke with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, via Skype from Managua, Nicaragua, Wednesday. A busy week, no major events, but a lot of stuff simmering on the sitting on the stove and cooking. I guess we could start with the ongoing protests, major protests in Chile, where some of those Chicago chickens have come home to roost, and I think they roasted first, and people are about ready to eat the chicken and get back to business.
Well, and it's certainly been very volatile over the last two or three weeks. Time we were talking, if I remember rightly, we're talking about the underlying reality that's driving all this volatility, which is the breakdown of the U.S.-imposed neoliberal austerity policies that favor the rich and marginalize the poor systematically and progressively. And those policies came up, as you'd expect they would, against very solid and very widespread popular resistance across the region, from South America to Central America to the Caribbean. And so, as you say, and one of the leading stories amidst all that volatility is what's happening in Chile. What you've got, the protests are still continuing. There was about a week or 10 days ago, there was the biggest ever demonstration of over a million people in Santiago de Chile, the biggest demonstration ever, according to local sources, protesting against both the repression of the protests, which aren't just in Santiago de Chile. It has to be pointed out that these are nationwide protests in every major city and many of the bit larger towns in Chile.
Right.
It's certainly not limited to the capital, Santiago. And there have been almost entirely peaceful protests, but that's what this huge demonstration about 10 days ago was protesting about. These peaceful protests have been viciously repressed, with all the worst signs of abuse and torture and abuse of authority by the police and the army, that recall even the worst days of the Pinochet regime. Now,
right.
And it looks as though, this time, there's a kind of semi-state. It's an autonomous body, the National Institute for Human Rights in Chile. And they've reported thousands of people wounded. I can't remember what the exact figure is. It's around at least 30, I think, people killed, and all very clearly as a result of action by the police and the army. And a lot of the people that were wounded, and there was a video, one video I saw of a young guy, apparently a student, who went up to a police officer, who apparently having been told to do so, and the police officer had a rifle and shot him in the leg. And it was that level of completely arbitrary brutality. And videos of people being thrown out of the back of police vehicles, dead in the street, and just horrific stuff. And the demonstrations were in part protesting about the police brutality, but also they were demanding that Sebastián Piñera's government pay attention to their demands. What are their demands? Basically, their demands require complete overhaul of Chile's constitution, which dates from the time of Pinochet.
You've got also, this was the first place that the first laboratory for the Chicago Boys' neoliberal austerity economics, which was a refinement of colonial economics, basically brought home and homogenized across the empire, more or less, where austerity was the order of the day. You had an interesting combination of, like, Adam Smith for the masses and, you know, Lenin for the rich or whatever. He socialized all the profit and handed it out to a very small group of people who considered themselves the totality of the economy. Everyone else, I guess, was office furniture and ended up as inventory and, you know, or whatever, or other mechanical tools and stuff. And they got nothing. You get oiled once in a while, or you get to rust on the shelf. And so, you know, Chile's had this since Pinochet took over after they murdered Allende. And he was in power until 1990 formally, I think, and a little later than that informally. But he didn't die till 2006. And then you had in 94... a president, who was a president for 6 years. You had Alagos, Bachelet, and Piñera taking turns from 2000 to the present. And it wasn't until, really, Michelle Bachelet that they sort of backed off that neoliberal model a little bit. And that was when this was prevalent, the model of backing off neoliberal economics started to prevail across Latin America and around the year 2000. And now, you know, they're going back to it, and there's nothing left in the well. This is one of the advantages of looking at one of the early models of Chicago neoliberalism, is you get to see it fully developed, and fully developed means everybody's broke except for the rich people.
Yeah, and fully developed means that the place is, the actual social structure is completely decrepit.
It's been hollowed out.
So, what you're right to point out, that Pinochet's shadow prevailed in, it loomed over public life in Chile long after he left office. Long after he was forced out of office as a result of a referendum. And the army in Chile has always been, you know, the kind of what do you call it, the 800-pound gorilla standing there beside you,
right,
in case you do anything wrong, like,
right. Well, you had, like I said, you had I don't think Pinochet didn't die actually until 2006. You know, from 2000 to 2006 you had Ricardo Lagos Escobar. He was a social democrat, but, you know, it was a center-left coalition that he barely squeaked in, right. And you had the army still, like, looking over everybody's shoulder and in most orifices with a flashlight. So there wasn't a whole lot of economic change that was allowed, even though he really was somebody who had an understanding of the need for that. He didn't really, I think, had either the inclination or particularly the political constituency to try to do anything about it. So, and once Pinochet was dead and everybody knew he wasn't coming back, I think there might have been a little bit of a breather that was taken.
You also have to take into account the context, because back then in 2000, when Lagos was elected president, and neoliberalism was still very much in vogue, and the Argentinian crisis was just breaking then, turning into an absolute monster of a crisis that completely destroyed Argentina's economy, and that subsequently Nestor Kirchner and Cristina Kirchner rebuilt. So when Pinochet died, by 2006, that was the year that you had the election of Evo Morales,
right,
in Bolivia. There was a strong wave back then of
a tide, if you will, a tide.
progressive leaders taking office, if not complete power, across the region. So. I can't remember if it was Bachelet that took office back then. Maybe it was a bit later, 2008. I can't remember. But when she had her first period in government, she was the benefit of the zeitgeist. She was a benefit of right. the feeling of the time.
Right.
But as you pointed out, even though Pinochet was dead, right. she was still limited in what she was able to do because the her majority. In fact, I'm not even sure that she had a majority.
Yeah, it was really close, whatever it was, yeah. Yeah, but this is what we see. We see this across the region. I mean, you know, in Brazil, the same thing, even in Venezuela. You know, the electorate divides like 55-45 when there's a big spread. Otherwise, it's 51-49, same with Argentina.
Yeah, and the difference in somewhere like, I mean, take Venezuela and Nicaragua, for example. The difference between Venezuela and Nicaragua and a country like Chile is that the army and the police have had how many decades right. to clean themselves up and actually right. work for the people they're supposed to
That's
serve.
Right. That's right.
And actually do that instead of serving the elite.
Right. Well, the role in both places, number one, you had Chavez, who came out of the army, who had a good amount of time. He understood how it worked, and he had a chance to clean it out. And in Nicaragua, you had a new army, essentially. You know, that
right.
was that was an actual armed revolution. And that army, I mean, of course, there were the contradictions of the Contra War and the way that was settled and all of the things that came out of it. But, the Sandinista forces became the army and certainly integrated into it. And so you didn't have the old army in place for sure. You have a whole different animal. So
even in Argentina got out of its dictatorship whenever it was in the mid 80s and just after the Malvinas War. So the army there and the police there, while they still have an extremely authoritarian ethic, and they've had that much longer than their Chilean equivalents to actually understand that they're supposed to serve ordinary people. Now, that, you know, and it's very uneven, but and I think it's true to say that Chile is probably on a par with Colombia in terms of the ethic of its police and its armed forces, and they're put into the service of the elites, and they do
right.
that, and they do what they're told ruthlessly,
right.
and often in the most cruel, sadistic way, as we can see happening in Chile.
Yeah.
So, and the current state of play in Chile seems to be that there's no sign of a let up in the demonstrations and the protests. Piñera has made some half-hearted moves to some gestures in the direction of trying to appease the outbreak of outrage against his administration and against his regime. I mean, I think it's fair to call it a regime, given the levels of protest against it. And they obviously don't have majority popular support. So, and he's like, for example, he's fired a bunch of ministers, they fired his cabinet and recruited in another bunch of people that are very similar to the people that he fired. He's making noises, and the legislature in Chile is making noises about introducing changes to the constitution. But the call on the street, essentially, as I understand it, is that people are becoming more and more adamant that the only thing that's going to meet their demands ultimately is a constituent assembly to formulate a new constitution for Chile,
right.
And that's hardly surprising, because the constitution that they have at the moment is a constitution derived directly from the dictatorship. It is completely anachronistic.
Right.
Right now.
Right.
So let's see what happens. Let's hope that the protesters manage to survive the repression that's being deployed against them, right. and that they do get their demands. And you can say that about almost anywhere where the protests are happening. Like, we have protests in Haiti.
Right.
They died down over the last few days, and there's some talk about a return to some kind of weak kind of normality. But I don't see how that that's going to just go away and evaporate because nothing has changed.
Well, Haiti is such a special case that requires like 85 extra layers of repression every time the people rise there. But before we leave Chile, just so people are aware of it, Piñera, this is his second crack at it. Michelle Bachelet was president from 2006 to 2010. Then Piñera was president from 2010 to 2014. Then Bachelet won again, and she was in from 2014 to 2018. And then Piñera has been president since 2018. This is his second whack at it, and the first time was not that remote in time from Pinochet.
Right. In terms of policies, that's kind of Tweedledum and Tweedledee, as we said in earlier programs.
Yeah, we saw Bachelet let loose at the UN, for example. She's no great shakes either.
She was regarded as a kind of, in a broad sense, progressive. But her actual policies in Chile, there were very widespread protests against her regime.
Right.
On the issue of the privatization of education and the access to university, over the whole issue of the privatized pension system that deprives the great majority of pensioners in Chile of anything approaching an adequate income in their retirement.
She was
unable to make any progress on those absolutely fundamental issues.
Well, they didn't re-elect her either the first time. It was only after they got a taste of Piñera that they voted for her again.
Right.
And
Piñera obviously doubled down on the wretched, pathetic lie that somehow you can turn an economy around using austerity policies, cutting back the state and liberalizing the economy even more than before, etc., etc., and you just can't.
Yeah, the way to give you more nutrients is to starve you. That's basically the logic of it.
Well, yeah, and essentially the logic is if we bend over backwards enough for the wealthy elite, maybe they'll give us a few
shekels at us. Yeah, right. It's cute.
Yeah, and that seems to be the logic.
The massive history to the contrary notwithstanding, right. So we were in Haiti, and the other thing I wanted to say is, for example, I mean, you have the most extreme kind of, order imposed or murderous regimes imposed on Haiti as opposed to the rest of, they make Pinochet look like a hero. Haiti's had dished out to it. Every time the people rise there and they throw off, the last group of dictators, let's go back to the docks, for example, their own leaders, they're not allowed to have them. They get kidnapped and flown off to the Central African Republic or, whatever. And then the most horrible people are put in power there, occupation armies from the United Nations, spreading of dysentery and all kinds of other diseases, and just out-and-out murder of people who dare to open their mouths. And now they're shaking it off again.
And a lot of people have been reporting extremely well on Haiti, I mean, whether it's Kim Eyes at Haiti Liberté or Daddy Chéri on her site, or in people like Jeb Sprague and other people. And they've been reporting on Haiti for years about the it's almost pure colonialism, but I mean it's just this side of colonialism. I mean the way the United States, France, and Canada have imposed a kind of an NGO UN style managerial regime that completely strips away autonomy and sovereignty and self-determination from the legitimate representatives of the Haitian people. And then on top of that, people in Haiti are hit time after time by these shocking, catastrophic natural disasters.
I know.
It's the earthquake, it's a hurricane.
Right.
So every time they're just trying to get up from having been knocked down, along comes a natural disaster from being knocked down by the imperialist powers. They're just trying getting it together to make a bit of headway, and they get hit over the head with a hurricane or an earthquake.
Yeah.
And it's just, and then the response to that on the part of the imperialist powers is even more corruption. And the role of the people like the Clintons in Haiti has been totally shameful. No, but I'm they're only the identifiable face of the whole system, which is the imperialist capitalist system. So I don't think Haiti is going to stay calm or get back to anything like normal, because what does normal mean in a context where the country is destroyed constantly by natural disasters and never recovers from that, and at the same time they have governments that are designed to continue looting the country even under those circumstances. And it's very difficult to see how Haiti can break out of that vicious negative cycle of destruction.
That's right.
And so, you know, and what can you say? And let's see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, you know, there's going to be one interesting dynamic to this. You know, we've seen how Trump has been willing to cater to the most reactionary members of the diaspora from Cuba and Nicaragua in Miami, and the Gusanos that he promised everything to in 2016. You know, he gave them some pretty outlandish stuff. The disorder in Nicaragua last year. The sanctions that were imposed on Nicaragua, Venezuela, and Cuba, the reorienting of policy to a degree with Cuba again, and, of course, the appointment of a new president for Venezuela. But he also, when he campaigned, he did that because he was campaigning in Florida, and this is, you know, a good part of the electorate there. But he also campaigned among the Haitian emigrant community in Florida, which is left-wing, and he did very well with them. And I'm interested to know if there's going to be a policy change out of Washington that compares favorably to the Clintons' policy, which has been basically to loot the place and to, you know, to loot possible sources of help also by saying, hi, yes, we know, horrible thing, the earthquake, give us some money, we'll take care of it, and then they keep the money. Instead, all Trump really has to do is keep the United States out of Haiti's internal affairs while the Haitians settle it. You know, don't fly their next president off to the Central African Republic or whatever, and you know, make sure that no one else does. Like, use the U.S. power to basically tell people, stay out of Haiti, let it fix itself. That would be something that would be, in essence, delivering a campaign promise to the Haitian emigrant community here in the United States. I'm curious to see if there's an ideological bias in his treatment of these things, or if he'll also do something equivalent to what's been done for the emigre communities here from Venezuela and Nicaragua and Cuba.
Well, who knows?
I know.
Whether Trump ever does what he promises is open to question.
And it won't matter much anyway.
But the key thing is that the U.S. State Department is not going to let him.
Anyway,
you know,
that's right.
The U.S. State Department is going to impose the policy. And I'll never forget that interview that the guy's name that used to be Negroponte's sidekick. He was the ambassador here in Nicaragua. Robert Callahan.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget what he said around the 2008 election. He was asked, and I think I've said this to you before, he was asked by a local reporter here, whether Obama's victory in 2008 would lead to a change in U.S. policy, foreign policy. And Callahan replied, I don't think so. United States policy towards Latin America has been the same for 50 years. I don't think it's going to change now. And so, you know, and that's from the horse's mouth, right?
Yep.
Okay, yep. So let's hope for the best. Keep our fingers crossed and hope for the best for Chile and pray for them.
Not sure which end of the horse it was from, but yeah, one end or the other it was from, absolutely.
One end or the other. So then,
what else? Colombia, right?
And on that note, and talking about U.S. policy in the region, Nicaragua, Venezuela, the latest beneficiary of U.S. policy is Bolivia. Yeah. And there in Bolivia, several programs ago, we had a conversation in which we were talking about how Bolivia was being set up for a similar kind of regime change attempt that took place in Nicaragua and Venezuela. Venezuela earlier this year, and Nicaragua last year in 2018.
Right.
And that has come to pass in the wake of the election result. And for I don't know why people talk about, some people are talking about Evo Morales winning very narrowly. And I don't understand that, because he won by over 10% of the vote.
Right.
And so, and it's, he had a very convincing electoral win that the OAS tried to question, whereas they, you know, it's a complete contrast to what they normally do when, if a right-wing government squeaks in and they get the full backing of the Organization of American States.
Right.
And if a left-wing government wins by a mile, and that that result is regarded as questionable.
Right.
And so the double standard in the Organization of American States is completely clear.
Yep.
And what Evo Morales, the president of Bolivia, has been insisting on is that what they're facing now is a coup attempt, similar to what happened in Venezuela and similar to what happened in Nicaragua.
Right.
And the characteristics of it are very clear and very similar to what happened in Nicaragua and Venezuela. Initially, the opposition were demanding that they wanted a recount because they wanted the vote to go to a second round. And then when the Electoral Tribunal in Bolivia declared that the result didn't call for a second round, because
right.
it satisfied the requisite difference in percentage terms for the winner to win on the first round, 10%. Then they said, well, we want a recount. And so then the OAS weighed in and said, yes, we want a recount too, and we want our decision to be binding on it. And, you know, it's a complete violation of Bolivia's sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
So Evo Morales negotiated and said, all right, we'll do a recount. It won't be binding in terms of what the OAS says, but if our electoral tribunal says that it was less than 10%, then we'll go to a second round. At that point, the opposition said, no, we don't want a recount. You've got to go. Evo's got to go. That's exactly the same progression that has happened in both Nicaragua and in Venezuela. The opposition make an initial demand. When that's kind of met, they intensify their demand, and ultimately they end up calling for an overthrow of the legitimately elected government. Now, if that's not a coup attempt, what is? But people are claiming that Evo Morales is exaggerating and there's no coup attempt.
Right.
So the current situation in Bolivia superficially mirrors some of the actions that have taken place, for example, during the protests in Ecuador, and for example, during the protests in Chile. And in Bolivia, what the right wing, based in the Santa Cruz area of Bolivia, a notoriously right wing racist area controlled by people who are members of the Bolivian elite. And they, and in previous years, and when there have been protests there, the armed thugs of these elite groups in Santa Cruz have attacked indigenous people and killed them just because they're indigenous. You know, that it's that level of racism that Evo Morales and the people of Bolivia are having to confront in this latest coup attempt, which, of course, is supported by the Organization of American States.
Right.
Whereas in Venezuela and in Nicaragua, the Organization of American States has supported the protests. And now they're doing the same in Bolivia,
right.
In Chile and Ecuador and other places.
Of course, they're
and
not.
They,
right.
they've attacked protests.
That's right. We got to stop here, though. We've got not just a double standard. I mean, it's a single standard. If you're with imperialism, we're on your side. And if you're not, we're not. And it's about how it sums up. But let's take a look at what develops, because today there's supposed to be some opposition rally and an attempt to force Morales to resign, which, of course, he's not going to do. And we can update people on that. And I thank you for your time.
Okay, you're very welcome, Don. It'll be interesting to see how things pan out over the next week.
Yes, it will. All right, thank you very much.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.